You are a man, and a man of honour. Come, and I will explain to you." And with a firm step, Morel went up to his cabinet, whilst Maximilian followed him, trembling as he went. Morel opened the door and closed it behind his son, then, crossing the anteroom, went to his desk, on which he placed the pistols, and pointed with his finger to an open ledger. In this ledger was made out an exact balance sheet of affairs. Morel had to pay within half an hour 287,500 francs. All he possessed was 15,257 francs. "Read," said Morel. The young man was overwhelmed as he read. Morel said not a word. What could he say? What need he add to such a desperate proof in figures? "And have you done all that is possible, father, to meet this disastrous result?" asked the young man after a moment's pause. "I have," replied Morel. "You have no money coming in on which you can rely?" "None." "You have exhausted every resource?" "All." "And in half an hour," said Maximilian, in a gloomy voice, "our name is dishonored." "Blood washes out dishonor," said Morel. "You are right, father. I understand you." Then, extending his hand towards one of the pistols, he said, "There is one for you and one for me." "Thanks." Morel checked his hand. "Your mother, your sister, who will support them?" A shudder ran through the young man's frame. "Father," he said, "do you reflect that you are bidding me to live?" "Yes, I do bid you," answered Morel. "It is your duty. You have a calm, strong mind, Maximilian. Maximilian, you are no ordinary man. I desire nothing. I command nothing. I only say to you, examine my position as if it were your own, and then judge for yourself." The young man reflected an instant, then an expression of sublime resignation appeared in his eyes, and with a slow and sad gesture, he took off his two epaulets, the marks of his rank. "Be it so, then, my father," he said, extending his hand to Morel. "Die in peace, my father." "I will live." Morel was about to cast himself on his knees before his son, but Maximilian caught him in his arms, and these two noble hearts were pressed against each other for a moment. "You know it is not my fault," said Morel. Maximilian smiled. "I know, father. You are the most honorable man I have ever known." "Good, my son. And now all is said. Go now and rejoin your mother and sister." "My father," said the young man, bending his knees, "bless me." Morel took his head between his two hands, drew him towards him, and kissing his forehead several times, said, "Oh, yes, yes, I bless you in my own name, and in the name of three generations of irreproachable men, who say by my voice, the edifice which misfortune has destroyed, Providence may build up again. On seeing me die such a death, the most inexorable will have pity on you. To you, perhaps, they will accord the time they have refused to me. Try that the word of disgrace be never pronounced. Go to work. Labor, young man. Struggle ardently and courageously. Live yourself, your mother, and sister with the most rigid economy, so that from day to day the property of those whom I leave in your hands may augment and fructify. Reflect how glorious a day it will be, how grand, how solemn that day of complete restoration, on which you will say in this very office, 'My father died because he could not do what I have this day done, but he died calmly and peaceably, because in dying he knew what I should do.'" "My father, my father," cried the young man, "why should you not live?" "If I live, all would be changed. If I live, interest would be converted into doubt, pity into hostility. If I live, I am only a man who has broken his word, failed in his engagements, in fact, only a bankrupt. If, on the contrary, I die, remember, Maximilian, my corpse is that of an honest but unfortunate man. Living, my best friends would avoid my house. Dead, all Marseille will follow me in tears to my last home. Living, you would feel shame at my name. Dead, you may raise your head and say, I am the son of him you killed because, for the first time, he has been compelled to fail in his word. The young man uttered a groan, but appeared resigned. And now, said Morel, leave me alone and endeavor to keep your mother and sister away. Will you not see my sister once more? Asked Maximilian. A last but final hope was concealed by the young man in the effect of this interview, and therefore he had suggested it. Morel shook his head. I saw her this morning, and bade her adieu. Have you no particular commands to leave with me, my father? Inquired Maximilian in a faltering voice. Yes, my son, and a sacred command. Say it, my father. The house of Thompson and French is the only one who, from humanity, or it may be selfishness, it is not for me to read men's hearts, have had any pity for me. His agent, who will in 10 minutes present himself to receive the amount of a bill of 287,500 francs, I will not say granted, but offered me 3 months. Let this house be the first repaid, my son, and respect this man. Father, I will, said Maximilian. And now, once more, adieu, said Morel. Go, leave me. I would be alone. You will find my will in the secretaire in my bedroom. The young man remained standing and motionless, having but the force of will and not the power of execution. Hear me, Maximilian, said his father. Suppose I were a soldier like you, and ordered to carry a certain redoubt, and you knew I must be killed in the assault. Would you not say to me, as you said just now, Go, father, for you are dishonored by delay, and death is preferable to shame? Yes, yes, said the young man. Yes. And once again embracing his father with convulsive pressure, he said, Be it so, my father. And he rushed out of the cabinet. When his son had left him, Morel remained an instant standing with his eyes fixed on the door. Then putting forth his arm, he pulled the bell. After a moment's interval, Cocles appeared. It was no longer the same man. The fearful convictions of the last 3 days had crushed him. This thought, the house of Morel is about to stop payment, bent him to the earth more than 20 years would otherwise have done. My worthy Cocles, said Morel, in a tone impossible to describe, do you remain in the antechamber? When the gentleman who came 3 months ago, the agent of the house of Thompson and French, arrives, announce his arrival to me. Cocles made no reply. He made a sign with his head, went into the anteroom and seated himself. Morel fell back in his chair, his eyes fixed on the clock. There were 7 minutes left, that was all. The hand moved on with incredible rapidity. It seemed to him as if he saw it progress. What then passed at this final moment of time in the mind of this man, who, still young, had by a course of reasoning, false perhaps, but at least specious, was about to separate himself from all he loved in the world, and quit life which possessed for him all domestic delights, it is impossible to express. To form the slightest idea of his feelings, he must have been seen with his brow bathed in perspiration, yet resigned, his eyes moistened with tears and yet raised to heaven. The clock hand moved on. The pistols were cocked. He stretched forth his hand, took one up, and murmured his daughter's name. Then he laid down the mortal weapon, took up his pen, and wrote a few words. It seemed to him as if he had not taken a sufficient farewell of his beloved daughter. Then he turned again to the clock. He no longer counted by minutes, but by seconds. He took up the deadly weapon again, his mouth half opened and his eyes fixed on the clock, and then shuddered at the click of the trigger as he cocked the pistol. At this moment of mortal agony, a damp, colder than death, passed over his brow. An agony stronger than death clutched at his heartstrings. He heard the door of the staircase creak on its hinges. The clock gave its warning to strike 11. The door of his cabinet opened. Morel did not turn round. He expected these words of Cockles, the agent of Thompson and French. He placed the muzzle of the pistol between his teeth. Suddenly he heard a cry. It was his daughter's voice. He turned and saw Julie. The pistol fell from his hands. "My father," cried the young girl, out of breath and half dead with joy. "Saved! You are saved!" And she threw herself into his arms, holding in her extended hand a red netted silk purse. "Saved? My child," said Morel. "What do you mean?" "Yes, saved, saved. See, see," said the young girl. Morel took the purse and started as he did so, for a vague remembrance reminded him that it once belonged to himself. At one end was the bill for the 287,500 francs receipted. At the other was a diamond as large as a hazelnut, with these words on a small slip of parchment: "Julie's dowry." Morel passed his hand over his brow. It seemed to him a dream. At this moment the clock struck 11. The sound vibrated as if each stroke of the hammer struck Morel's heart. "Explain, my child," he said. "Explain. Where did you find this purse?" "In a house in the Allée de Meilhan, number 15, on the corner of a mantelpiece, in a small room on the fifth floor." "But," cried Morel, "this purse is not yours." Julie handed to her father the letter she had received in the morning. "And did you go alone?" asked Morel, after he had read it. "Emmanuel accompanied me, father. He was to have waited for me at the corner of the Rue de Musée, but, strange to say, he was not there when I returned." "Monsieur Morel!" exclaimed a voice on the stairs. "Monsieur Morel!" "It is his voice," said Julie. At this moment Emmanuel entered, his countenance full of animation and joy. "The Pharaon!" he cried. "The Pharaon!" "What? What? The Pharaon? Are you mad, Emmanuel? You know the vessel is lost. The Pharaon, sir. They signal the Pharaon. The Pharaon is entering the harbour." Morel fell back in his chair. His strength was failing him. His understanding, weakened by such events, refused to comprehend such incredible, unheard-of, fabulous facts. But his son came in. "Father," cried Maximilian, "how could you say the Pharaon was lost? The watchtower has signaled her, and they say she is now coming into port." "My dear friends," said Morel, "if this were so, it must be a miracle of heaven. Impossible, impossible." But what was real and not less incredible was the purse he held in his hand, the acceptance receipted, the splendid diamond. "Ah, sir," exclaimed Cocklus, "what can it mean? The Pharaon!" "Come, my dear," said Morel, rising from his seat, "let us go and see, and heaven have pity upon us if it be false intelligence." They all went out, and on the stairs met Madame Morel, who had been afraid to go up into the cabinet. In an instant they were at the Canebière. There was a crowd on the pier. All the crowd gave way before Morel. "The Pharaon! The Pharaon!" said every voice. And wonderful to say, in front of the Tower of Saint-Jean was a ship bearing on her stern these words, printed in white letters: "The Pharaon, Morel and Son, of Marseille." It was precisely resembling the other Pharaon, and loaded as that had been with cochineal and indigo. It cast anchor, brailed all sails, and on the deck was Captain Gormard giving orders, and Maître Penelon making signals to Monsieur Morel. To doubt any longer was impossible. There was the evidence of the senses and 10,000 persons who came to corroborate the testimony. as Morel and his son embraced on the pierhead, in the presence and applause of the whole city witnessing this prodigy, a man with his face half covered by a black beard, and who, concealed behind the sentry box, watched the scene with delight, uttered these words in a low tone: "Be happy, noble heart. Be blessed for all the good thou hast done and wilt do hereafter, and let my gratitude rest in the shade with your kindness." And with a smile in which joy and happiness were revealed, he left his hiding place and, without being observed, descended one of those flights of steps which serve for debarkation, and hailing three times, shouted, "Jacopo! Jacopo! Jacopo!" Then a shallop came to shore, took him on board, and conveyed him to a yacht splendidly fitted up, on whose deck he sprung with the activity of a sailor. Thence he once again looked towards Morel, who, weeping with joy, was shaking hands most cordially with all the crowd around him, and thanking with a look the unknown benefactor whom he seemed to be seeking in the skies. "And now," said the unknown, "farewell, kindness, humanity, and gratitude. Farewell to all the feelings that expand the heart. I have been heaven's substitute to recompense the good. Now the God of vengeance yields to me his power to punish the wicked." At these words he gave a signal, and as if only awaiting this signal, the yacht instantly put out to sea. 31. Italy, Sinbad the Sailor. Towards the commencement of the year 1838, two young men belonging to the First Society of Paris, the Viscount Albert de Morcerf and the Baron Franz d'Epinay, were at Florence. They had agreed to see the carnival at Rome that year, and that France, who for the last 3 of 4 years had inhabited Italy, should act as cicerone to Albert. As it is no inconsiderable affair to spend the carnival at Rome, especially when you have no great desire to sleep on the Place du Peuple or the Campo Vaccino, they wrote to Maitre Pastrini, the proprietor of the Hôtel de Londres, Place d'Espagne, to reserve comfortable apartments for them. Maitre Pastrini replied that he had only 2 rooms and a cabinet al secondo piano, which he offered at the low charge of a louis per diem. They accepted his offer, but wishing to make the best use of the time that was left, Albert started for Naples. As for France, he remained at Florence. After having passed several days here, during which time he promenaded in the paradise called the Cascines, and spent 2 or 3 evenings at the houses of the nobles of Florence, he took a fancy into his head, having already visited Corsica, the birthplace of Bonaparte, to visit Elba, the halting place of Napoleon. One evening he loosened a bark from the iron ring that secured it to the port of Leghorn, laid himself down wrapped in his cloak at the bottom, and said to the crew, "To the Isle of Elba." The bark shot out of the harbour like a bird, and the next morning France disembarked at Porto Ferrajo. He traversed the island after having followed the traces which the footsteps of the giant have left, and re-embarked for Marciana. 2 hours after, he again landed at Pianosa, where he was assured red partridges abounded. The sport was bad. France only succeeded in killing a few partridges, and like every unsuccessful sportsman, he returned to the boat very much out of temper. "Ah, if your excellency chose," said the captain, "you might have capital sport." "Where?" "Do you see that island?" continued the captain, pointing to a conical pile that rose from the sea. "Well, what is this island?" "The island of Monte Cristo." "But I have no permission to shoot over this island." "Your excellency does not require a permission, for the island is uninhabited."
"Ah, indeed," said the young man. "A desert island in the midst of the Mediterranean must be a curiosity. It is very natural. This isle is a mass of rocks and does not contain an acre of land capable of cultivation. To whom does this island belong?" "To Tuscany." "What game shall I find there?" "Thousands of wild goats." "'Who live upon the stones, I suppose,' said France, with an incredulous smile. "'No, but by browsing the shrubs and trees that grow out of the crevices of the rocks. "'Where can I sleep? On shore, in the grottos, or on board, in your cloak. "'Besides, if your excellency pleases, we can leave as soon as the chase is finished. "'We can sail as well by night as by day, and if the wind drops, we can use our oars.' As France had sufficient time, and besides had no longer his apartments at Rome to seek after, he accepted the proposition. Upon his answer in the affirmative, the sailors exchanged a few words together in a low tone. "Well," asked he, "what, is there any difficulty to be surmounted?" "No," replied the captain, "but we must warn your excellency that the island is contumacious." "What do you mean? That Monte Cristo, although uninhabited, yet serves occasionally as a refuge for the smugglers and pirates who come from Corsica, Sardinia, and Africa, and that if it becomes known that we have been there, we shall have to perform quarantine for 6 days on our return to Leghorn." "The devil! That is quite another thing. Rather a long time, too. But who will say your excellency has been to Monte Cristo?" "Oh, I shall not," cried France. "Nor I, nor I," chorused the sailors. "Then steer for Monte Cristo." The captain gave his orders, the helm was put up, and the bark was soon sailing in the direction of the island. France waited until all was finished, and when the sail was filled and the four sailors had taken their place, three forward and one at the helm, he resumed the conversation. "Gitano," said he to the captain, "you tell me Monte Cristo serves as a refuge for pirates, who are, it seems to me, a very different kind of game from the goats." "Yes, your excellency, and it is true. I knew there were smugglers, but I thought that since the capture of Algiers and the destruction of the Regency, pirates only existed in the romances of Cooper and Captain Marryat." "Your excellency is mistaken. There are pirates like the bandits who were believed to have been exterminated by Pope Leo XII, and who yet every day rob travellers at the gates of Rome. Has not your excellency heard that the French chargé d'affaires was robbed 6 months ago within 500 paces of Velletri?" "Oh yes, I heard that." "Well, then, if, like us, your excellency lived at Leghorn, you would hear from time to time that a little merchant vessel or an English yacht that was expected at Bastia, at Porto Ferrajo, or at Civita Vecchia has not arrived. No one knows what has become of it, but doubtless it has struck on a rock and foundered. Now, this rock it has met has been a long and narrow boat, manned by 6 or 8 men, who have surprised and plundered it some dark and stormy night near some desert and gloomy isle, as bandits plunder a carriage at the corner of a wood." "But," asked France, who lay wrapped in his cloak at the bottom of the bark, "why do not those who have been plundered complain to the French, Sardinian, or Tuscan governments?" "Why?" said Gitano, with a smile. "Yes, why? Because, in the first place, they transfer from the vessel to their own boat whatever they think worth taking, then they bind the crew hand and foot, they attach to everyone's neck a 4-and-20-pound ball, a large hole is pierced in the vessel's bottom, and then they leave her. At the end of 10 minutes the vessel begins to roll, labour, and then sink. Then one of the sides plunges, and then the other. It rises and sinks again. Suddenly a noise like the report of a cannon is heard. It is the air blowing up the deck. Soon the water rushes out of the scupper holes like a whale spouting. The vessel gives a last groan, spins round and round, and disappears, forming a vast whirlpool in the ocean. And then all is over, so that in 5 minutes nothing but the eye of God can see the vessel where she lies at the bottom of the sea. Do you understand now," said the captain, "why no complaints are made to the government, and why the vessel does not arrive at the port?"
It is probable that if Gaetano had related this previous to proposing the expedition, France would have hesitated ere he accepted it, but now that they had started, he thought it would be cowardly to draw back. He was one of those men who do not rashly court danger, but if danger present itself, combat it with the most unalterable sang-froid. He was one of those calm and resolute men who look upon a danger as an adversary in a duel, who, calculating his movements, study his attacks, who retreat sufficiently to take breath, but not to appear cowardly, who, understanding all their advantages, kill at a single blow. "Bah," said he, "I have travelled through Sicily and Calabria. I have sailed 2 months in the archipelago, and yet I never saw even the shadow of a bandit or a pirate. I did not tell your excellency this to deter you from your project," replied Gaetano, "but you questioned me, and I have answered, that's all. Yes, and your conversation is most interesting, and as I wish to enjoy it as long as possible, steer for Monte Cristo." The wind blew strongly. The bark sailed 6 or 7 knots an hour, and they were rapidly reaching the end of their voyage. As they approached, the isle became larger, and they could already distinguish the rocks heaped on one another like bullets in an arsenal, in whose crevices they could see the green bushes and trees that were growing. As for the sailors, although they appeared perfectly tranquil, yet it was evident that they were on the alert, and that they carefully watched the glassy surface over which they were sailing, and on which a few fishing boats with their white sails were alone visible. They were within 15 miles of Monte Cristo when the sun began to set behind Corsica, whose mountains appeared against the sky, and showing their rugged peaks in bold relief. This mass of stones, like the giant Adamastor, rose threateningly before the bark, from which it shaded the sun that gilded its lower parts. By degrees the shadow rose from the sea and seemed to drive before it the last rays of the expiring day. At last the reflection rested on the summit of the mountain, where it paused an instant like the fiery crest of a volcano. Then the shadow gradually covered the summit as it had covered the base, and the isle now only appeared to be a grey mountain that grew continually darker. Half an hour after, and the night was quite dark. Fortunately, the mariners were used to these latitudes and knew every rock in the Tuscan archipelago, for in the midst of this obscurity, France was not without uneasiness. Corsica had long since disappeared, and Monte Cristo itself was invisible, but the sailors seemed like the lynx to see in the dark, and the pilot, who steered, did not evince the slightest hesitation. An hour had passed since the sun had set, when France fancied he saw, at a quarter of a mile to the left, a dark mass, but it was impossible to make out what it was, and, fearing to excite the mirth of the sailors by mistaking a floating cloud for land, he remained silent. Suddenly, a great light appeared on the strand. Land might resemble a cloud, but the fire was not a meteor. "What is this light?" asked he. "Silence," said the captain. "It is a fire. But you told me the isle was uninhabited. I said there were no fixed habitations on it, but I said also that it served sometimes as a harbour for smugglers." "And for pirates?" "And for pirates," returned Gaetano, repeating France's words. "It is for that reason I have given orders to pass the isle, for, as you see, the fire is behind us."
"But this fire," continued France, "it seems to me rather to assure than alarm us. Men who did not wish to be seen would not light a fire."
"Oh, that goes for nothing," said Gaetano. "If you can guess the position of the isle in the darkness, you will see that the fire cannot be seen from the side or from Pianosa, but only from the sea." "You think, then, that this fire announces unwelcome neighbors?" "That is what we must ascertain," returned Gaetano, fixing his eyes on this terrestrial star.
"How can you ascertain?"
"You shall see."
Chitano consulted with his companions, and after 5 minutes' discussion, a maneuver was executed which caused the vessel to tack about. They returned the way they had come, and in a few minutes the fire disappeared, hidden by a rise in the land. The pilot again changed the course of the little bark, which rapidly approached the isle, and was soon within 50 paces of it. Chitano lowered the sail, and the bark remained stationary. All this was done in silence, and since their course had been changed, not a word was spoken. Chitano, who had proposed the expedition, had taken all the responsibility on himself. The 4 sailors fixed their eyes on him whilst they prepared their oars and held themselves in readiness to row away, which, thanks to the darkness, would not be difficult. As for France, he examined his arms with the utmost coolness. He had 2 double-barreled guns and a rifle. He loaded them, looked at the locks, and waited quietly. During this time, the captain had thrown off his vest and shirt and secured his trousers round his waist. His feet were naked, so he had no shoes and stockings to take off. After these preparations, he placed his finger on his lips, and lowering himself noiselessly into the sea, swam towards the shore with such precaution that it was impossible to hear the slightest sound. He could only be traced by the phosphorescent line in his wake. This track soon disappeared. It was evident that he had touched the shore. Everyone on board remained motionless during 30 minutes, when the same luminous track was again observed, and in 2 strokes he had regained the bark. "Well," exclaimed Franz and the sailors altogether, "they are Spanish smugglers," said he. "They have with them 2 Corsican bandits. And what are these Corsican bandits doing here with Spanish smugglers?" "Alas," returned the captain, with an accent of the most profound pity, "we ought always to help one another. Very often the bandits are hard pressed by gendarmes or carbineers. Well, they see a bark and good fellows like us on board, they come and demand hospitality of us. You can't refuse help to a poor hunted devil. We receive them, and for greater security we stand out to sea. This costs us nothing and saves the life, or at least the liberty, of a fellow creature who, on the first occasion, returns the service by pointing out some safe spot where we can land our goods without interruption."
"Ah," said Franz, "then you are a smuggler occasionally, Gitano?"
"Your Excellency, we must live somehow," returned the other, smiling in a way impossible to describe.
"Then you know the men who are now on Monte Cristo?"
"Oh, yes. We sailors are like Freemasons and recognize each other by signs. And do you think we have nothing to fear if we land?"
"Nothing at all. Smugglers are not thieves."
"But these 2 Corsican bandits, said Franz, calculating the chances of peril. "It is not their faults that they are bandits, but that of the authorities."
"How so?"
"Because they are pursued for having made a po, as if it was not in a Corsican's nature to revenge himself."
"What do you mean by having made a po?"
"Having assassinated a man?" said Franz, continuing his investigation.
"I mean that they have killed an enemy, which is a very different thing," returned the captain.
"Well," said the young man, "let us demand hospitality of these smugglers and bandits. Do you think they will grant it?"
"Without doubt."
"How many are they?"
4,
and the 2 bandits make 6.
"Just our number, so that if they prove troublesome, we shall be able to check them. So, for the last time, steer to Monte Cristo."
"Yes, but your Excellency will permit us to take all due precautions."
"By all means. Be as wise as Nestor and as prudent as Ulysses. I do more than permit. I exhort you."
"Silence, then," said Gitano. Everyone obeyed.
For a man who, like Franz, viewed his position in its true light, it was a grave one. He was alone in the darkness with sailors whom he did not know and who had no reason to be devoted to him, who knew that he had in his belt several 1,000 francs, and who had often examined his arms, which were very beautiful, if not with envy, at least with curiosity. On the other hand, he was about to land without any other escort than these men on an island whose name was religious, but which did not seem to Franz likely to afford him much hospitality, thanks to the smugglers and bandits. The history of the scuttled vessels, which had appeared improbable during the day, seemed very probable at night. Placed as he was between two imaginary dangers, he did not quit the crew with his eyes or his gun with his hand. However, the sailors had again hoisted the sail, and the vessel was once more cleaving the waves. Through the darkness, Franz, whose eyes were now more accustomed to it, distinguished the granite giant by which the bark was sailing, and then, turning an angle of the rock, he saw the fire, more brilliant than ever, round which five or six persons were seated. The blaze illumined the sea for 100 paces round. Gaetano skirted the light, carefully keeping the bark out of its rays. Then, when they were opposite the fire, he entered into the center of the circle, singing a fishing song, of which his companions sung the chorus. At the first words of the song, the men seated round the fire rose and approached the landing place, their eyes fixed on the bark, of which they evidently sought to judge the force and divine the intention. They soon appeared satisfied and returned, with the exception of one who remained at the shore, to their fire, at which a whole goat was roasting. When the bark was within 20 paces of the shore, the man on the beach made with his carbine the movement of a sentinel who sees a patrol, and cried, "Who goes there?" in Sardinian. Franz coolly cocked both barrels. Gaetano then exchanged a few words with this man, which the traveller did not understand, but which evidently concerned him. "Will your excellency give your name, or remain incognito?" asked the captain. "My name must rest unknown. Merely say I am a Frenchman travelling for pleasure." As soon as Gaetano had transmitted this answer, the sentinel gave an order to one of the men seated round the fire, who rose and disappeared among the rocks. Not a word was spoken. Everyone seemed occupied. Franz with his disembarkment, the sailors with their sails, the smugglers with their goat. But in the midst of all this carelessness, it was evident that they mutually observed each other. The man who had disappeared returned suddenly on the opposite side to that by which he had left. He made a sign with his head to the sentinel, who, turning to the bark, uttered these words, "Saccomodi." The Italian "saccomodi" is untranslatable. It means at once, "Come, enter, you are welcome, make yourself at home, you are the master." It is like that Turkish phrase of Molière's that so astonished le bourgeois gentilhomme by the number of things it contained. The sailors did not wait for a second invitation. Four strokes of the oar brought them to the land. Gaetano sprang to shore, exchanged a few words with the sentinel, then his comrades descended, and lastly came Francis' turn. One of his guns was swung over his shoulder, Gaetano had the other, and a sailor held his rifle. His dress, half artist, half dandy, excited no suspicion, and consequently no disquietude. The bark was moored to the shore, and they advanced a few paces to find a comfortable bivouac. But doubtless the spot they chose did not suit the smuggler who filled the post of sentinel, for he cried out, "Not that way, if you please." Gaetano faltered an excuse and advanced to the opposite side, whilst two sailors kindled torches at the fire to light them on their way. They advanced about 30 paces and then stopped at a small esplanade, surrounded with rocks in which seats had been cut, not unlike sentry boxes. Around in the crevices of the rocks grew a few dwarf oaks and thick bushes of myrtles. Franz lowered a torch and saw by the light of a mass of cinders that he was not the first to discover this retreat, which was, doubtless, one of the halting places of the wandering visitors of Monte Cristo. As for his anticipation of events, once on terra firma, once that he had seen the indifferent, if not friendly, appearance of his hosts, his preoccupation had disappeared, or rather, at sight of the goat, had turned to appetite. He mentioned this to Shitano, who replied that nothing could be more easy than to prepare a supper when they had in their boat bread, wine, half a dozen partridges, and a good fire to roast them by. Besides, added he, if the smell of their roast meat tempts you, I will go and offer them two of our birds for a slice. You seem born for negotiation, returned France. Go and try. During this time, the sailors had collected dried sticks and branches with which they made a fire. Franz waited impatiently, smelling the odor of the goat, when the captain returned with a mysterious air. Well, said Franz, anything new? Do they refuse? On the contrary, returned Shitano. The chief, who was told you were a young Frenchman, invites you to sup with him. Well, observed Franz, this chief is very polite, and I see no objection. The more so as I bring my share of the supper. Oh, it is not that. He has plenty and to spare for supper. But he attaches a singular condition to your presentation at his house.
His house? Has he built one here, then?
No. But he has a very comfortable one all the same, so they say. You know this chief, then? I have heard talk of him.
Ill or well?
Both.
The devil.
And what is this condition? That you are blindfolded, and do not take off the bandage until he himself bids you.
Franz looked at Shitano to see, if possible, what he thought of this proposal.
Ah, replied he, guessing Franz's thought, I know this merits reflection. What should you do in my place? I, who have nothing to lose? I should go. You would accept?
Yes,
were it only out of curiosity. There is something very curious about this chief, then.
Listen, said Shitano, lowering his voice. I do not know if what they say is true.
He stopped to look if anyone was near.
What do they say? That this chief inhabits a cavern to which the Pitti Palace is nothing.
What nonsense, said Franz, reseating himself.
It is no nonsense. It is quite true.
Karma, the pilot of the San Ferdinand, went in once, and he came back amazed, vowing that such treasures were only to be heard of in fairy tales.
Do you know, observed Franz, that with such stories you would make me enter the enchanted cavern of Ali Baba?
I tell you what I have been told.
Then you advise me to accept?
Oh, I don't say that. Your Excellency will do as you please. I should be sorry to advise you in the matter.
Franz reflected a few moments, felt that a man so rich could not have any intention of plundering him of what little he had, and seeing only the prospect of a good supper, he accepted. Gitano departed with the reply. Franz was prudent and wished to learn all he possibly could concerning his host. He turned towards the sailor, who during this dialogue had sat gravely plucking the partridges with the air of a man proud of his office, and asked him how these men had landed, as no vessel of any kind was visible.
"Never mind that," returned the sailor. "I know their vessel.
Is it a very beautiful vessel?
I would not wish for a better to sail round the world.
Of what burden is she?
About 100 tons." But she is built to stand any weather. She is what the English call a yacht.
Where was she built?
I know not, but my own opinion is she is a Genoese.
And how did a leader of smugglers, continued Franz, venture to build a vessel designed for such a purpose at Genoa?
I did not say that the owner was a smuggler, replied the sailor.
No, but Gitano did, I thought.
Gitano had only seen the vessel from a distance. He had not then spoken to anyone.
And if this person be not a smuggler, who is he?
A wealthy signor who travels for his pleasure.
Come, thought Franz, he is still more mysterious, since the two accounts do not agree.
What is his name?
If you ask him, he says Sinbad the Sailor. But I doubt its being his real name.
Sinbad the Sailor?
Yes.
And where does he reside?
On the sea.
What country does he come from?
I do not know. Have you ever seen him?
Sometimes.
What sort of a man is he? Your Excellency will judge for yourself. Where will he receive me?
No doubt in the subterranean palace Shitano told you of.
Have you never had the curiosity, when you have landed and found this island deserted, to seek for this enchanted palace?
Oh, yes, more than once, but always in vain. We examined the grotto all over, but we never could find the slightest trace of any opening. They say that the door is not opened by a key, but a magical word.
Decidedly, muttered Franz, this is an adventure of the Arabian Nights.
His Excellency waits for you, said a voice which he recognized as that of the sentinel.
He was accompanied by two of the yacht's crew. Franz drew his handkerchief from his pocket and presented it to the man who had spoken to him. Without uttering a word, they bandaged his eyes with a care that showed their apprehensions of his committing some indiscretion. Afterwards he was made to promise he would not make the least attempt to raise the bandage. He promised. Then his two guides took his arms, and he advanced, guided by them, and preceded by the sentinel. After advancing about 30 paces, he smelt the appetizing odor of the kid that was roasting, and knew thus that he was passing the bivouac. They then led him on about 50 paces farther, evidently advancing towards the shore, where they would not allow Gitano to penetrate, a refusal he could now comprehend. Presently, by a change in the atmosphere, he comprehended that they were entering a cave. After going on for a few seconds more, he heard a crackling, and it seemed to him as though the atmosphere again changed and became balmy and perfumed. At length his feet touched on a thick and soft carpet, and his guides let go their hold of him. There was a moment's silence, and then a voice, in excellent French, although with a foreign accent, said, "Welcome, sir. I beg you will remove your bandage." It may be supposed, then, Franz did not wait for a repetition of this permission, but took off the handkerchief, and found himself in the presence of a man from 38 to 40 years of age. This personage was dressed in a Tunisian costume, that is to say, a red cap with a long blue silk tassel, a vest of black cloth embroidered with gold, pantaloons of deep red, large and full gaiters of the same color, embroidered with gold, like the vest, and yellow slippers. He had a splendid cashmere round his waist, and a small, sharp and crooked kanjia was passed through his girdle. Although of a paleness that was almost livid, this man had a remarkably handsome face. His eyes were penetrating and sparkling. A nose, quite straight and projecting direct from the brow, gave out the Greek type in all its purity, whilst his teeth, as white as pearls, were set off to admiration by the black moustache that encircled them. This pallor was so peculiar that it seemed as though it were that which would be exhibited by a man who had been enclosed for a long time in a tomb, and who was unable to resume the healthy glow and hue of the living. He was not particularly tall, but extremely well made, and, like the men of the south, had small hands and feet. But what astonished Franz, who had treated Gitano's description as a fable, was the splendor of the apartment in which he found himself. The entire chamber was lined with crimson brocade, worked with flowers of gold. In a recess was a kind of divan, surmounted with a stand of Arabian swords in silver scabbards, and the handles resplendent with gems. From the ceiling hung a lamp of Venetian glass of beautiful shape and color, whilst the feet rested on a Turkey carpet in which they sunk to the instep. Tapestry hung before the door by which Franz had entered, and also in front of another door leading into a second apartment, which seemed to be brilliantly lighted up. The host gave Franz time for his surprise, and, moreover, rendered him look for look, not even taking his eyes off him. "Sir," he said after some pause, "a thousand excuses for the precaution taken in your introduction hither, but as, during the greater portion of the year, this island is deserted,
If the secret of this abode were discovered, I should doubtless find on my return my temporary retirement in a great state of disorder. That would be exceedingly annoying, not for the loss it occasioned me, but because I should not have the certainty I now possess of separating myself from all the rest of mankind at pleasure. Let me now endeavour to make you forget this temporary unpleasantness, and offer you what, no doubt, you did not expect to find here, that is to say, a tolerable supper and pretty comfortable beds.
Ma foi, my dear sir, replied France, make no apologies. I have always observed that they bandage people's eyes who penetrate enchanted palaces, for instance those of Raoul in the Huguenots, and really I have nothing to complain of, for what I see is a sequel to the wonders of the Arabian Nights.
Alas, I may say with Lucullus, if I could have anticipated the honour of your visit, I would have prepared for it. But such as is my hermitage, it is at your disposal. Such as is my supper, it is yours to share, if you will. Ali, is the supper ready?
At this moment the tapestry moved aside, and a Nubian, as black as ebony, and dressed in a plain white tunic, made a sign to his master that all was prepared in the salle à manger. Now, said the unknown to France, I do not know if you are of my opinion, but I think nothing is more annoying than to remain 2 or 3 hours tête-à-tête without knowing by name or appellation how to address one another. Pray observe that I too much respect the laws of hospitality to ask your name or title. I only request you to give me one by which I may have the pleasure of addressing you. As for myself, that I may put you at your ease, I tell you that I am generally called Sinbad the Sailor. And I, replied France, will tell you, as I only require his wonderful lamp to make me precisely like Aladdin, that I see no reason why at this moment I should not be called Aladdin. That will keep us from going away from the East, whither I am tempted to think I have been conveyed by some good genius.
Well then, Signor Aladdin, replied the singular amphitryon, you heard our repast announced. Will you now take the trouble to enter the salle à manger, your humble servant going first to show the way? At these words, moving aside the tapestry, Sinbad preceded his guest.
Franz proceeded from one enchantment to another. The table was splendidly covered, and once convinced of this important point, he cast his eyes around him. The salle à manger was scarcely less striking than the boudoir he had just left. It was entirely of marble, with antique bas-reliefs of priceless value, and at the four corners of this apartment, which was oblong, were 4 magnificent statues having baskets on their heads. These baskets contained 4 pyramids of most splendid fruit. There were the pineapples of Sicily, pomegranates from Malaga, oranges from the Balearic Isles, peaches from France, and dates from Tunis. The supper consisted of a roast pheasant garnished with Corsican blackbirds, a boar's ham à la gelée, a quarter of a kid à la tartare, a glorious turbot, and a gigantic lobster. Between these large dishes were smaller ones containing various dainties. The dishes were of silver, and the plates of Japanese china. Franz rubbed his eyes in order to assure himself that this was not a dream. Ali alone was present to wait at table, and acquitted himself so admirably that the guest complimented his host thereupon. Yes, replied he, whilst he did the honours of the supper with much ease and grace. Yes, he is a poor devil who is much devoted to me, and does all he can to prove it. He remembers I saved his life, and as he has a regard for his head, he feels some gratitude towards me for having kept it on his shoulders. Ali approached his master, took his hand, and kissed it. Would it be impertinent, Signor Sinbad, said France, to ask you the particulars of this kindness?
Oh, they are simple enough, replied the host. It seems the fellow had been caught wandering nearer to the harem of the Bey of Tunis than etiquette permits to one of his colour, and he was condemned by the Bey to have his tongue cut out and his hand and head cut off.
the tongue the first day, the hand the second, and the head the third. I always had a desire to have a mute in my service, so learning the day his tongue was cut out, I went to the bay and proposed to give him for Ali a splendid double-barreled gun, which I knew he was very desirous of having. He hesitated a moment. He was so very desirous to complete the poor devil's punishment. But when I added to the gun an English cutlass with which I had shivered His Highness's yataghan to pieces, the Bey yielded and agreed to forgive the hand and head, but on condition he never again set foot in Tunis. This was a useless clause in the bargain, for whenever the coward sees the first glimpse of the shores of Africa, he runs down below and can only be induced to appear again when we are out of sight of that quarter of the globe. Franz remained a moment mute and pensive, hardly knowing what to think of the half-kindness, half-cruelty with which his host related the brief narrative. And like the celebrated sailor whose name you have assumed, he said, by way of changing the conversation, you pass your life in travelling? Yes, I made a vow at a time when I little thought I should ever be able to accomplish it, said the unknown, with a singular smile. And I made some others also, which I hope I may fulfill in due season. Although Sinbad pronounced these words with much calmness, his eyes darted gleams of singular ferocity. "You have suffered a great deal, sir?" said Franz inquiringly. Sinbad started and looked fixedly at him as he replied, "What makes you suppose so?" "Everything," answered Franz. "Your voice, your look, your pallid complexion, and even the life you lead." "I? I live the happiest life possible, the real life of a pasha. I am king of all creation. I am pleased with one place and stay there. I get tired of it and leave it. I am free as a bird and have wings like one. My attendants obey me at a signal. Sometimes I amuse myself by carrying off from human justice some bandit it is in quest of, some criminal whom it pursues. Then I have my mode of dispensing justice, silent and sure, without respite or appeal, which condemns or pardons and which no one sees. Ah, if you had tasted my life, you would not desire any other, and would never return to the world unless you had some great project to accomplish there. A vengeance, for instance," observed Franz. The unknown fixed on the young man one of those looks which penetrate into the depth of the heart and thoughts. "And why a vengeance?" he asked. "Because," replied Franz, "you seem to me like a man who, persecuted by society, has a fearful account to settle with it." "Ah," responded Sinbad, laughing with his singular laugh which displayed his white and sharp teeth. "You have not guessed rightly. Such as you see me, I am a sort of philosopher, and one day perhaps I shall go to Paris to rival Monsieur Appert and the little man in the blue cloak." "And will that be the first time you ever took that journey?" "Yes, it will. I must seem to you by no means curious, but I assure you that it is not my fault I have delayed it so long. It will happen one day or the other." "And do you propose to make this journey very shortly?" "I do not know. It depends on circumstances which depend on certain arrangements. I should like to be there at the time you come, and I will endeavour to repay you as far as lies in my power for your liberal hospitality displayed to me at Monte Cristo." "I should avail myself of your offer with pleasure," replied the host, "but unfortunately if I go there it will be in all probability incognito." The supper appeared to have been supplied solely for Franz, for the unknown scarcely touched one or two dishes of the splendid banquet to which his guest did ample justice. Then Ali brought on the dessert, or rather took the baskets from the hands of the statues and placed them on the table. Between the two baskets he placed a small silver cup, closed with a lid of the same. The care with which Ali placed this cup on the table roused Franz's curiosity. He raised the lid and saw a kind of greenish paste, something like preserved angelica, but which was perfectly unknown to him. He replaced the lid, as ignorant of what the cup contained as he was before he had looked at it, and then, casting his eyes towards his host, he saw him smile at his disappointment.
You cannot guess, said he, what there is in that small vase, can you?
No, I really cannot.
Well then, that kind of green preserve is nothing less than the ambrosia which Hebe served at the table of Jupiter.
But, replied France, this ambrosia, no doubt in passing through mortal hands, has lost its heavenly appellation and assumed a human name. In vulgar phrase, what may you term this composition for which, to say the truth, I do not feel any particular desire?
Ah, thus it is that our material origin is revealed, cried Sinbad. We frequently pass so near to happiness without seeing, without regarding it, or if we do see and regard it, yet without recognizing it.
Are you a man for the substantials, and is gold your god? Taste this, and the mines of Peru, Gusara, and Golconda are opened to you. Are you a man of imagination, a poet? Taste this, and the boundaries of possibility disappear. The fields of infinite space open to you. You advance free in heart, free in mind, into the boundless realms of unfettered